To those of you who are visiting with us today, we thank you for your decision. We realize it was a decision, and we're glad you came. We hope you'll sign our guest register before you leave, as we always request that. We'd love to have a record of your visit. I think many of us are tired after last week, but it's a good tired. I don't mind being tired from things like we enjoyed last week. And we're still rejoicing over the obedience of the gospel of Brother Harris yesterday, Harris Townsley. And there are probably a lot of factors that figured into that, but I've probably none more than what we read in 1 Peter chapter 3, which says, "In like manner, ye wives, be in subjection to your own husbands, that even if any obey not the word, they may without the word be gained by the behavior of their wives, beholding your chaste behavior coupled with fear." And we're so appreciative of LaVonda and the example that she has set and all the many things that she does behind the scenes. And that had a lot to do with it, I'm sure. This morning, we're talking about God and the problem of evil. And it is a problem. The problem of evil has traditionally been viewed as simply a form of conflict involving three concepts. And those three concepts are God's power and God's goodness and the presence of evil in the world. How in the world do you figure all that out? How can you harmonize all those things? And that's a problem to a lot of people. A lot of people haven't figured it out and haven't been able to harmonize it, and they've made some decisions. Their solution typically involves modifying one or more of those. Either they want to modify God's power, they want to limit it, or they want to limit God's goodness, or they want to modify the existence of evil and call it an illusion, or something like that. And today we face the reality of both moral evil, two kinds of evil. Moral evil would be evil committed by people of free will, such as war and crime and cruelty and class struggles and discrimination and slavery and ethnic cleansing and suicide bombings and genocide, infanticide, and various injustices that we can think of. Moral evil. And then what we also call natural evil, things that occur in the universe, like hurricanes and floods and earthquakes and tornadoes and tsunamis and volcanoes and things like that that occur. And because moral evil and natural evil exists, and because this evil seemingly can't be reconciled with the presence of a good and all-loving God, all-powerful God, then because of that, atheists have chosen to renounce belief in God altogether. Agnostics and skeptics remain unsure on the issue. The Christian believes there is a coherent explanation that's consistent with the existence of an all-good, all-powerful God. And that's the faith that causes us and sustains us throughout life. And so we want to talk about that. We're going to examine several objections. And I don't usually preach series of sermons. A lot of people don't like series. That's not the reason. Just not my nature. But this one's going to be a two-parter. We'll finish it up tonight. We won't get it all said today, this morning. But as we look at those objections, the first one we want to look at is the notion that evil is merely a privation of good. And that's false. And that's what they say. That atheist Walter Sinnott Armstrong said, "It would be a sick joke to try to comfort parents whose child just died by saying that their child is not really dead, but merely deprived of life." And so there's a proper response to that. Philosophically speaking, evil's not something that has an existence all its own. We've got to understand that. It's a corruption of that which already exists. And that makes a big difference. Evil is indeed the absence of the privation or the deprivation of something good. For example, rot can only exist as long as the tree exists. Tooth decay can only exist as long as the tooth exists. Rust on a car, a decaying carcass, blind eyes, deaf ears, all illustrate the same point. And evil exists as a corruption of something good. But it doesn't have an existence of its own. It's a privation, and it doesn't have essence of itself. And so evil's like a wound in the arm or a moth hole in a garment, something like that. It exists only in another, but not of itself. And evil always parasitizes good. Indeed, all of our words for evil presuppose a good that has been perverted. Impurity presupposes purity. Unrighteousness presupposes righteousness. Deviation presupposed a way from which we've deviated or departed. And sin presupposes a target that was missed. And so on. So this is what we want to say about evil as we think about this notion of it being a deprivation of good. Now, actually, I believe we can be a little more precise than that. Evil involves the absence of something good that ought to be there. It ought to be there. And when good that should be in something is not in that something, that's evil. And we're not using evil always here to mean sinful, referring to natural evil. For example, health ought to be in the human body. But sometimes people get cancer, and that's evil. And hearing ought to be in the ear, but sometimes people go deaf. And sight ought to be in the eye, and people go blind. And this evil in this world we think of. And I want you to notice, by contrast, that the tree in my front yard cannot see. But that's not evil because my tree was never meant to see. So that's not evil. And likewise, if my nose is missing a wart, that's not evil because a wart was never supposed to be on my nose to begin with. Sometimes it happens, but that wasn't intended. And so to repeat, evil involves the absence of something good that ought to be there, like sight to the eye. And it's absent. Now, as for Senator Armstrong's jab that it would be a sick joke for somebody to try to comfort parents who lost a child by saying that that child not really dead, but merely deprived of life, that's rather absurd, because no Christian would ever stoop to making a statement like that in the first place, and Christians wouldn't under any circumstances deny that the child had died. But that doesn't change the fact that this death involves a deprivation of life in the child's body. When speaking to the child's parents, the Christian would point them to the hope of eternal life in Jesus Christ. Whereas all the atheist would be able to say is that your child is gone for good, you'll never see him again, and there is no God, and there is no afterlife, get over it. That's what he would have to say if he was honest about it. So we need to see the contrast between those two. Now then, there's another objection that's made, and it is the existence of evil in the universe proves there is no good, all-powerful God. And so if a person's going to claim that there's no God, if they're going to do that because there's so much evil in the world, then we need to first ask the question, by what criteria is something judged evil in the first place? What are you judging that by? You know, that's a dilemma for the atheist. How does one judge some things to be evil and not others? What is the moral measuring stick whereby you say this is evil and this is not? How do we know evil when we see it? And by what process do you identify it? Kind of like Socrates demonstrated long ago to make a distinction between particulars in which one is good and one is evil. He said you must have a universal or absolute standard by which you measure it. And I agree with that, not because Socrates said it, but because that's true. That's so. Once you see this, then the ultimate result is that without an infinite reference point to good, no one can identify what good or evil is. Everybody's up to his own ideas of what it is. And thus, without the existence of God, there is no evil or no good in an absolute sense, but everything becomes relative. And to each person, it's relative. So what's your idea of good and evil may not be mine. What may be that person's may be something else. And so we're just all confused. And we're getting that in our country. We're getting morally confused because of that idea. So the problem of evil doesn't negate the existence of God. It actually requires it. So we can have a standard by which we measure it. We can have a measuring stick by which we say something is good and something's not. So you see how that argument actually turns itself around against the atheist and the agnostic. He needs a standard. When he talks about good and evil, he needs to be pressed. What standard are you using to measure that with? We need to ask him that. And so the point is that it's impossible to distinguish evil from good unless one has an infinite reference point that is absolutely good, an infinite one. And so otherwise, we'd be like the person at sea on a cloudy night without a compass. And there would be no way to distinguish north from south without the absolute reference point of the needle pointing north. That's the only way we could do it. God is our reference point for distinguishing good from evil. That's where we began. That's how we establish what is good or what is evil. And an atheist may try to use this to his advantage in some way. Even though he says God doesn't exist, he will use a standard that God has given to decide that some things are evil. And so if you're going to talk about good and evil, I want to know what you're measuring it by. That deserves an answer. Now, there's another reason why the reality of evil doesn't disprove the existence of God. When God originally created the universe, it was perfect. It was perfectly good in every way. God saw that what he had made, and it was very good. There in Genesis chapter 1 and verse 31. There was no evil. There was nothing in the universe of which it could be said that something good ought to be there, but it was missing. That could not be said about anything. Everything was good. And today, not everything is good. It's not. A great deal of evil now exists in the universe that was once entirely good when God created it. And that can only mean one thing. Something dreadfully happened between then and now to cause that change. What was it? Well, there was a colossal perversion of good that occurred. And so there had been an invasion of sin. The existence of evil in our universe doesn't disprove the existence of God any more than termites in a house disprove the existence of the architect. They don't do that. And the fact that ugliness and thorn and death and pain and chaos are present in the world doesn't disprove design. And infestation of termites doesn't prove the house didn't have an architect. And vandalism or arson doesn't prove the house doesn't have an architect. And sloppy homeowners who don't paint their house or keep the garage like they should, that doesn't prove the house didn't have an architect. What those are, these are matters simply raise the question about the situation of the house since it was built. Since it was built. And so theologically, the Bible is clear that God exists and that he created the universe in a perfectly good state. The Bible is also clear that things have changed dramatically. And we read that throughout the Bible, that the earth is running down. It waxeth old like a garment. And God created the world because of human sin. And things are not now what they were created to be, as they were created to be in Genesis 3. God's original design has been corrupted by an intruder. That's what's happened. The intruder is sin. God's good universe that he created is no longer good. Reason for God's allowance of evil, those are going to become clearer as we proceed. But we want to point out also another objection that is made, and that is, if there is an all-good, all-powerful God, he should get rid of all evil now, right now. Well, let's think about that for a moment. I think we'd be wise to rethink it, the idea that God should simply get rid of all evil immediately. Choosing that option would have a definite and fatal implication to each one of us. Because if God was to stamp out evil today, he would do a complete job. He never does anything halfway. His action would have to include our lies. It would have to include personal impurities, our lack of love, our failure to do good. Now, suppose God were to decree that at midnight tonight, all evil will be removed from this universe. Who would be here after midnight? Nobody. Nobody would be here after midnight. So we need to be clear about one thing. Desiring a universe in which God brings about instant justice has the definite downside of yielding a peopleless universe, an unpopulated universe. Absent the cross, you and I and everybody else would be absolute goners. We would be gone for good. Show over. And so God would be the only one left. After all, each of us has committed some evil at some time in our lives, whether it be by commission or omission, by word or deed or thought, in the interest of self-preservation. And I'm glad that God doesn't wipe out all evil immediately. And so, do you think he hasn't thought of that? Do you think he hasn't thought of that? I'm glad he's long-suffering, like the Bible teaches that he is. So those who make that argument need to go back and rethink that. Now then, that's why we're still here. God believes it's important to remember that he's not finished yet, and that's why he's still here, we're still here. And that's why it's simply wrong to conclude that God's not dealing with the problem of evil just because he doesn't wipe it out immediately, once and for all, in this present moment. And certainly God's definitive dealings with evil is yet future. We're told that. When he's going to deal with it directly, and the wrath of God will be poured out. You know, when we read a good novel or maybe see a good movie, if there are any, we often don't understand everything that's taken place until we get to the very end of the book or movie. And we're trying to put it together all throughout. We can't figure it out. And that's when our perspective to the story becomes complete, when we get to the end. And that's when we say, oh, I get it now. How many times have we done things like that? We read a book and then it all came together right at the very end. And that's where our perspective of the story becomes complete. Well, it's kind of that way regarding the human story. And there'll come a time when we'll say, I get it now. I hope we don't wait too late, though, to do that. And the human story is going to become clear, though, at that point. And meanwhile, we can rest assured that God has put boundaries for our good on the spread of evil. God has even taken steps to ensure that evil doesn't run utterly amok. And here's some things that he's done. God has given human governments by which to withstand lawlessness. And he's given them the job of rewarding good and punishing evil, according to Romans 13. Christ founded the church to be a light in the midst of darkness. He did that. And to strengthen God's people, and even to restrain the growth of wickedness by teaching his word in the world throughout the power of the sword of the Spirit, which is the word of God. It's the pillar and ground of the truth. And God has given us the family unit that helps bring stability to society. And it's when we start abandoning that things start falling apart. And God has also given us his word. He's given us a moral standard to guide us and to keep us on the right path. And God has promised a future day of accounting, of reckoning, in which all human beings will face the divine judge, according to Hebrews 9:27. And for Christians, an awareness of that future day serves as a deterrent to committing evil and evil acts on other people. So God is doing some things. He has done some things. He set in motion for us. Now then, there's another objection, and that one is, if there was an all-good and all-powerful God, surely he would have arranged things so that human beings would never sin. Now, a scenario in which people never had the possibility of sinning would necessitate that we be no longer truly human. We wouldn't really be humans anymore if that were the case. They would no longer have the capacity to make choices and to freely love. And that scenario would require that God create us as robots who act only in programmed ways. Like that. Like one of those chatty dolls where you have to pull the string and it says, I love you. When you pull that string, it doesn't really mean it. It just says that. But there would never be any love. There never would be. Love is a voluntary thing. It's a decision one makes. God could make us robots, but we would cease to be men if he did. We wouldn't be men anymore. God apparently thought it was worth the risk creating us as we are. And so love is the highest value in the universe, and in the world of robots, such love would be entirely absent. Real love, our love for God, our love for one another, must involve a choice. we choose to love. And with that granting of that choice comes the possibility that people may also make a bad choice and choose to hate. Love cannot be programmed in a coercive way. People can't be coerced to love. And so it must be freely expressed. Unless human beings can freely choose not to love, they can't freely choose to love. There has to be that freedom of choice there. The possibility of one that necessitates the possibility of the other one. And so God wanted Adam and Eve and all humanity to show love by freely choosing to obey Him. And that's why He gave humans free will. And yet a free choice always leaves the possibility of a wrong choice. Evil is inherently possible. It's inherently possible in the risky gift of free will. But God didn't create evil. So it's wise to consider that there are certain things that God cannot do simply because they're not in the realm of the possible. Sometimes people say, well, God can do all things. All things are possible with God. The Bible does say that. But it means all things that are in the realm of possibility. There are some things that wouldn't fit there, like He can't make square circles, He can't make square circles or round squares, because that involves contradictory terms. That's why. And it's not because God couldn't do them if He just had more power. It's because they simply are, by definition, terms that contradict each other, and thus they're nonsense. It's nonsense to talk about a square circle or a round square. And so there are some things that the Bible does tell us that are impossible to God. It tells us it's impossible for God to lie. God cannot lie. That would violate His holy nature. He wouldn't be holy anymore. It's impossible for God to eliminate all evil without eliminating free choice. And it's logically impossible to make someone freely do something. If you made them do it, they didn't do it freely. If they did it freely, they weren't made to do it, were they? So you can't have both of those at the same time. And so if you had to make them do it, then they didn't do it freely. Now, think about that, because free choice of necessity, and it's a necessity to the existence of a moral universe like we live in, a universe that includes the free expression of love, of doing that. God can't eliminate that without eliminating this good moral universe. And the only way God could guarantee that His free creatures would never choose wrongly would be to tamper with their freedom, tamper with their free will. That's what He would have to do. And so if God is there to stop you every time you're about to take a wrong action, then you wouldn't have the freedom to act. You couldn't do that. And there would be no, that still wouldn't take care of the evil in the human heart that motivated that intended action. It wouldn't take care of that. So God's intentionally distracting a person with free will, that only stops the outward manifestation. It doesn't stop the intent of the heart and the evil that was there. So it comes down to this: either God gives free will to humans or He does not. Or He does not. If He gives them freedom, then they maintain the capacity to actually use that freedom. They have to, rightly or wrongly. And at this point, the atheist may object, and he may say that if evil is due to human free will, then God is ultimately responsible for evil, since that if evil is due to human free will, then God's responsible for that because He gave man free will. But God gave the man the freedom to choose. From the very beginning, He's not responsible for how we use it anymore. Well, for example, as we think about that, Henry Ford is the cause of all Ford cars. He invented the Ford automobile. He could well have envisioned misuses of that automobile, but he apparently felt it was wiser in a kind of a benefits analysis to go ahead and make them. He did that, rather than not make them. However, when a person who is under the influence of intoxicants gets behind the wheel of a Ford car, and he ends up in a head-on collision that kills innocent people, we can't blame Henry Ford for that. And we can't blame the Wright brothers for all the plane crashes because somebody made a wrong decision, because they had free will. So they misused their free will. And God's not responsible for people misusing their free will when he's tried to get them to make the right choices. And so although some married couples may hesitate to bring children into the world, into a fallen world with all the risk and the evils, most people do choose to have children. Most of them do. And apparently they conclude that the evil far outweighs the inestimable value of a loving relationship with their children and their grandchildren and throughout their lives. So they choose to have children rather than not have them. And in a similar vein, God concluded it was better to create than not create. So that brings us up to a stopping point. We're going to stop there, and we're going to talk some more tonight. But there's some other questions we want to get to. This one here, natural disasters cannot be blamed on human free will and sin. Since horrible natural disasters occur regularly in our world, it's impossible that an all-good, all-powerful God exists. Atheists make that argument. And they also say that because Christianity has been used throughout church history as an excuse for brutal, heartless, and senseless atrocities, Christianity cannot be true. We're going to talk about those tonight and see whether they're valid as we think about this subject. But now then, we want to talk about something else, and that is your need to obey the gospel if you haven't done that. Everybody needs to obey the gospel of Christ. And as we think about that, Jesus, God sent Jesus to die on the cross for us. God did not spare his own son from the cross. What makes you think he'll spare you from rejecting the cross? Think about that. God didn't spare his own son from the cross. What makes you think he'll spare you from rejecting him? Well, a person may say, well, I don't reject the cross. I believe in the cross. Well, do you? Let's notice what the Bible says. Know ye not that so many of us as were baptized into Jesus Christ were baptized into his death? We were buried, therefore, with him through baptism into death, that like as Christ was raised up from the dead through the glory of the Father, so we also might walk in newness of life. Blood contacted when we're baptized into his death. If you reject baptism, you've rejected the benefits of the cross. You have rejected the cross. Baptism is where the benefits of the cross are applied. If you reject baptism, you reject the cross. So when people say, oh, I believe in the cross, I don't reject the cross. If you rejected what the Bible says about baptism, you've rejected the cross. Because that's where the blood of Christ is applied. But something else to think about here, and that is, if God, and a lot of people have problems with this, some people have felt that if they had to do anything at all, that they'd be earning their salvation. And that's not true. Jesus said, when you have done all that is your duty to do, you're still an unprofitable servant. Luke 17 and verse 10. When you've done all that your duty to do, you're still an unprofitable servant. So we can't earn it. That settles that. So when we meet the condition that he stated it, we're not earning it. Think about it like this. If God had to do something so that we would believe and trust him, and he did, why should we be surprised that when we believe and trust him, God says we have to do something? And we do. A lot of people won't accept that top part there, about God had to do something to get me to love him and trust him. But me having to do something to prove I love him and trust him? Oh, no. See how people think? That's wrong. God did do something. And when we do that something, we're not earning our salvation. What he did was, he died on the cross. And he died and was buried and was raised on the third day. We die to sin. We're buried in a watery grave of baptism. And we're raised to walk in newness of life. That's what Christ wants us to do. And that's why we're told that we're baptized into his death, which is where he shed his blood. But notice something else. In the book of 1 Corinthians, and I'll get it right in a minute. I missed one chart there, I think. Well, anyway, let's take a look at it in the Bible. Always read the instruction book. In the book of Colossians, in chapter 2 and verse 11. Actually, we'll begin with verse 12. Verse 12 says, having been buried with him in baptism, wherein you were also raised with him through faith in the working of God who raised him from the dead. Some translations say, through the operation of God. God performs an operation. After all, the great physician. And you being dead through your trespasses and the uncircumcision of your flesh, you, I say, did you make alive together with him, having forgiven us all our trespasses. When did he forgive us of all of our trespasses? When we were buried with him in baptism, having faith in the operation of God. If you don't have faith in the operation of God, if you don't think God's powerful enough to do that, something's wrong with your faith. It needs to increase drastically, dramatically. And so, thinking about that, where does that leave you as you stand before God? All of us need to know where we stand before God. We need to think about that really often. But do we have faith in the operation of God enough to do what he asked us to do? When we wanted him to do something to prove he loved us and that we ought to trust him, we shouldn't think it strange that we have to do something in order to prove to him that we trust him. This morning, if you're subject to the Lord's invitation, you haven't obeyed the gospel, why not do it now as we stand and sing the hymn that's been selected?